lead Ayatollah Khamenei criticizes the U.S. for its hypocritical foreign policies and distortion of facts for its own benefit. The United States reiterates that it will not offer Iran unilateral incentives for talks about both sides resuming compliance with the 2015 nuclear deal. Also coming up, the European Parliament condemns the Bahraini regime's human rights violations and urges Manama to release all political prisoners. It's good to have you with us. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has criticized the United States for its double standards and hypocritical foreign policies. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Husseini Khamenei has accused Washington of distorting facts for its own benefit and turning a blind eye to the appalling human rights record of its allies.
Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has denounced the policies of the United States. In his speech marking the occasion of Eid al-Mab'ath, Ayatollah Khamenei slammed Washington for building military bases in the region under the pretext of fighting terrorism and called for the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq and Syria. Ayatollah Khamenei said Washington is the only country that has used nuclear weapons in action, but it claims to be against weapons of mass destruction. He noted that Washington still has the biggest nuclear arsenal in the world. Iran's leader also accused Washington of turning a blind eye as its Arab allies keep bombarding civilians in Yemen. He pointed out that Washington and even the United Nations, however, raised an outcry as soon as the people of Yemen started defending themselves against the Saudi-led aggressors. Elsewhere in his remarks, Ayatollah Khamenei said the United States is inverting the truth by claiming to support human rights while supporting those who violate them. Washington's double standards were also highlighted in remarks made by Iran's foreign minister. In a tweet, Mohammad Javad Zarif said the new U.S. administration is still sticking to a policy of maximum pressure against Iran but claims to favor diplomacy. Zarif also denounced Washington's move to block the release of Iranian assets frozen in South Korea. He noted that Iran needs the fund to purchase food and medicine as the country is fighting to contain the spread of the new coronavirus. Iran's foreign minister made the comments after U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken announced Washington's opposition to unfreezing of the Iranian funds by South Korea. Blinken said the money will only be released when Iran returns to full compliance with the 2015 nuclear deal. Tehran, however, says it will only reverse its commitment cuts once Washington removes all its unilateral sanctions against the Islamic Republic. Iranian officials argue it was the U.S. that threw the agreement into crisis by its withdrawal and must therefore be the one who returns to it first. On the surface, it looks like the new administration in the White House has chosen to adopt less hawkish policies and engage more with the world. But in reality, little has changed since Joe Biden took the helm in January. Eyes are now on the Biden administration to see whether Washington will choose to give up its bullying or keep on the same beaten track.
And Washington says it won't offer any incentives to bring Tehran to the negotiating table for talks about how to revive the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. State Department spokesman Ned Price said the U.S. won't make any unilateral gestures before Tehran resumes full compliance with the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Iran and the U.S. are locked in a standoff over which side should act first to salvage the international agreement. Tehran has repeatedly rejected engaging in any talks with Washington, saying all anti-Iran sanctions must be lifted first. Iran has scaled back its commitments under the deal, citing the remaining signatories' failure to honor their obligations. The Islamic Republic says the steps are reversible once all parties to the accord return to full compliance. Political commentator Frank Emspach says many American politicians don't consider the U.S. withdrawal from the JCPOA in 2018 a wrong move.
The Republicans completely and a significant portion of the Democrats never supported the nuclear treaty in the first place. So you're dealing with a situation where ideologically the President of the United States and most of his advisors see Iran as the problem and do not really recognize that activities that the United States engaged in, that is withdrawing from the treaty, are in and of themselves a violation of the treaty. So when you start with this kind of position, moving forward is extremely difficult. Without a strong, strong push from other people, both in the United States and I think amongst the Europeans. Without that, I don't see that much is going to happen here.
Now, Iran's foreign ministry says it's time for Saudi Arabia to, quote, wake up to realities and stop the carnage in Yemen. In a tweet, the ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh noted that Saudi dreams of conquering Yemen in 3 weeks have not been realized after 6 years. He accused Riyadh of defying principles of morality by bombarding the famine-stricken people of Yemen. Since 2015, the Saudis have been waging a devastating military campaign to reinstate Yemen's former regime. Now, Riyadh is under growing pressure from the international community to end the intervention. This as Yemeni fighters have stepped up their retaliatory operations against the kingdom's military and economic installations. Meanwhile, Yemen's military unveils new indigenously produced equipment as Sana'a steps up its retaliatory operations against Saudi-led aggressors. In an exhibition held in Sana'a, the Yemeni military displayed missiles, drones and artillery, as well as naval mines and light weapons. The Yemeni armed forces also introduced their latest ballistic and cruise missiles. Meanwhile, the Yemeni army said the country's armed forces are determined to continue their retaliatory strikes on Saudi Arabia until Riyadh ends its war and blockade on its southern neighbor. The Saudi-led war, which began in March 2015, has killed tens of thousands of Yemenis, many of them women and children. Journalist and commentator Yusuf Mawri says the Yemeni army's achievements have caused Saudi-backed forces to lose their morale.
They're starting to lose ground in territory in other places in Yemen. And they're also starting to lose morale because we've seen military defections take place throughout this war. But now those military defections are taking place at a higher level. And that what that tells you is those who are fighting on the Saudi side, they have very low morale because they understand that they're fighting on behalf of a benevolent regime that only wants to secure the interest of its Western powers and wants to starve an entire nation to reach that goal. They underestimated the will of the Yemeni people. If this was just the efforts of one sect or one party in Yemen, then maybe that would have been the case. Maybe Saudi Arabia thought that it could just destroy the Ansar Allah movement within a matter of 2 weeks and 3 weeks. But what they didn't realize is that the fabric of the Yemeni society supported the Ansar Allah movement.
Elsewhere, the European Parliament has condemned the Al Khalifa regime for its human rights violations and the worsening human rights situation in Bahrain. In a resolution issued on Thursday, the European Parliament called on Manama to release political prisoners and halt death sentences. The European Union's institution called on the Bahraini monarchy to stop harassing rights defenders and lift travel bans on them. Bahrain's popular uprising began in February 2011, but was soon dealt with an iron fist. Since then, the Al Khalifa regime has detained rights campaigners, broken up major opposition political parties, and revoked the nationality of several pro-democracy activists. Political commentator Eric Wahlberg says the European Parliament has issued a resolution to condemn Bahrain but has avoided slamming Israel's violation of human rights.
Well, it's encouraging that they're taking that step. Last year, the UN Committee for Rights of the Child also condemned Bahrain. They seem to be arresting a lot of children and submitting them to torture and not letting them see their parents. It's interesting that Bahrain just made this recognition of Israel last year, and it seems to be a good ally. Israel does exactly the same to Palestinian children, and it's interesting that the EU will take the initiative to condemn Bahrain, but you don't hear it talking about Israel, which is a far greater infringer of the rights of children and the rights of prisoners.
Turning to other news now, Brazil has registered over 2,000 new COVID-19 deaths for the second day in a row. The South American country has the world's second highest COVID-19 death toll, with fatalities nearing 273,000. Brazil's total number of cases has soared past 11.2 million as the country logged over 75,000 new cases. The surge in cases has pushed many hospitals close to the breaking point. Elsewhere in Latin America, Mexico recorded more than 650 daily fatalities, bringing the overall death toll to more than 193,000. The country also posted around 6,500 new cases, taking its total to over 2.1 million. This is while the government says the real number of infections is significantly higher than the confirmed one. New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio has joined the chorus of calls for Governor Andrew Cuomo to step down as allegations of sexual misconduct against him pile up.
It's deeply troubling, the specific allegation that the governor called an employee of his, someone who he had power over, called them to a private place, and then sexually assaulted her, is absolutely unacceptable. It is disgusting to me. And he can no longer serve as governor. It's as simple as that.
De Blasio said it is deeply troubling that as many as six women have come forward with the harassment claims. The Democratic mayor is the most prominent politician to demand his fellow party members' resignation. Nearly 60 Democratic members of New York's legislature have also called on the governor to quit. As impeachment calls grow, the New York State Assembly Speaker says he will meet with members to discuss potential paths forward. The office of New York State Attorney General is leading an investigation into the allegations. Cuomo has denied the claim, saying he will not resign. The United Nations says killings, torture, and persecution of anti-coup protesters by Myanmar's ruling military junta may constitute crimes against humanity.
Yesterday, the UN Security Council released a statement expressing their deep concern about developments in Myanmar. They condemned the violence against peaceful protesters and expressed continued support for a democratic transition. In the written report that I filed last week, I documented a total of 23 murders. As of this moment, credible reports indicate that Myanmar security forces have murdered at least 70 people.
The UN human rights investigator on Myanmar said more than 2,000 people have been unlawfully detained since the military seized power and the violence is steadily increasing. He called on the international community to help the people of Myanmar. The Southeast Asian country has been in turmoil since the military overthrew the government over allegations of voter fraud in the last parliamentary elections. The crude prices in India have skyrocketed in recent weeks, putting common man in a tremendous pressure. The fuel price has been one of the key poll issues used by opposition parties in the five poll-bound states to corner the ruling BJP. Manawa Zaman reports from New Delhi.
Crude oil is considered one of the backbones of the Indian economy, and recent months have seen a sharp rise in the crude prices. Petrol prices are at an all-time high in the state of Mumbai, while diesel, the main driver of industrial activity, is being sold for more than 88 rupees a liter, raising transportation costs. The government of Prime Minister Narendra Modi for now has shifted the blame for high prices on previous governments and production cuts by some oil exporting nations. Experts say the rising crude prices will put pressure on the country's economy that's heavily dependent on imports and has just recovered from a deep recession following COVID-19 pandemic, which shattered the world economy. While many experts believe that the government could cut taxes on petrol and diesel ahead of election in 5 key states, they, however, warn that the persistent higher prices could lead to inflation, which could threaten the path to recovery. They say both state and central government should act swiftly.
Prices are at historic high. Now, both the state governments and the central governments, they both will have to jointly come with reduction. Now, state governments have their own issues, and they, despite the fact that all the opposition parties, they are trying to make out a case for reduction, but they are not acting.
While the revenues gained from taxes on retail fuel is key for government to boost spending in the economy that exited a rare recession, the central bank sees those levies along with elevated crude prices a benefit. But experts say any withdrawal of the easy monetary policies to combat price growth will lead to a spike in borrowing costs, in turn hurting consumption and business activity at a time when millions of Indians are still out of work due to pandemic. Experts say the turmoil in West Asia is also a factor driving oil prices, especially for India, which is import-driven economy. Meanwhile, a new report by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development predicts India will be among the large economies most severely hit by the COVID-19 pandemic and the lockdown restrictions to combat it. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Iran's capital Tehran has hosted a conference on the Persian New Year known as Nowruz. The event brought together representatives from countries that celebrate the ancient festivity. Yusuf Jalali reports.
Spring is about to kick in, and nations that celebrate Nowruz are gearing up to ring in the Persian New Year. Gathering in Tehran is attended by representatives from all countries that mark the ancient tradition of Nowruz, including Iran, Afghanistan, and Tajikistan. They're here to exchange views on the history of the long-standing festivity and share their unique customs in celebrating the occasion.
The Nowruz festival in Tajikistan starts with a nationwide ceremony called Golgardani, where children who carry flowers go door to door and share the flowers with different families.
Every year during Nowruz, we take part in the Roses Festival, which is hosted by the city of Mazar Sharif, and people from all over the country gather there to celebrate.
During the Roses Festival in Afghanistan, we have a special performance called Molla Mahmad Jan, which is an exciting love story.
Nowruz means new day in Persian, and it marks the first day of spring in the Northern Hemisphere. To Iranians, it translates into a time to refresh the soul from all bad memories and make a fresh start in the year ahead.
In Iran, days ahead of Nowruz, all Iranians do the spring cleaning tradition. But what is more is the fact that not only do we dust off our houses, but we also purify our minds and our souls from any bad experiences. That's why Nowruz is regarded as a festival of peace, when nations come together and celebrate far from any political considerations.
Nowruz is now a recognized tradition in the world. In 2009, the United Nations proclaimed Nowruz an international event at the initiative of 12 countries that shared this event, including Iran, Afghanistan, India, and Turkey. Nowruz has been celebrated by Iranians since 3 millennia ago. This year, mass celebrations will largely be limited in the wake of the coronavirus. But that's what Nowruz is all about. Throw away bad thoughts, and let's hope that in the Persian New Year, the virus will leave us alone. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Brings it into our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
diverse range of programs. Youth, spirituality, culture, Eastern tales, roundtable discussions, politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
As the pandemic continues to upend lives across the world, it has impacted the entire food supply chain, says Robin Scheer, writer, in an article published under the heading, The Real Deadly Global Pandemic, Acute Food Shortages as the World Panics Over COVID-19, shutting businesses and disrupting food supply chains, millions are at risk of starvation. Stay tuned for the details, please. According to a United Nations World Food Programme report, COVID-19 might have left up to 265 million people with acute food shortages in 2020. The combined effect of the pandemic and the emerging global recession could, without larger-scale coordinated action, disrupt the functioning of food systems, which would result in consequences for health and nutrition of a severity and a scale unseen for more than half a century, states another UN report. In the United States of America, food insecurity has doubled overall and tripled among households with children because of the pandemic, states a June 2020 report by the Institute for Policy Research, IPR, at Northwestern University, which relied on data provided by the U.S. Census Bureau's Household Pulse Survey. In a recent interview with CBS News, IPR Director Dionne Whitmore warned that these statistics would likely continue to hold, with the numbers indicating particularly dramatic rises in food insecurity among Black and Hispanic families. Globally, the effects of COVID-19 on food security are equally, if not more, severe. According to a CBS News report, WFP Director David Beasley told the UN Security Council in April 2020 that the world is on the brink of a hunger pandemic. WFP Director David Beasley added, In a worst-case scenario, we could be looking at famine in about 36 countries, and in fact, in 10 of these countries, we already have more than 1 million people per country who are on the verge of starvation. Mark Lowcock, the Under Secretary General and Emergency Relief Coordinator at the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, OCHA, and Alex Van Trottenberg, Managing Director of Operations at the World Bank, wrote, The number of chronically hungry people increased by an estimated 130 million last year to more than 800 million, about 8 times the total number of COVID-19 cases to date. Countries affected by conflict and climate change are particularly vulnerable to food insecurity. Empty stomachs can stun whole generations. The U.S. Department of Agriculture, USDA, warns that climate change is likely to diminish continued progress on global food security through production disruptions that lead to local availability limitations and price increases, interrupted transport conduits, and diminished food safety. The same might be said about the pandemic, which has made it abundantly clear. Climate resilience, food security, and global health are closely intertwined. In terms of food security, another major concern is the pandemic-related school closures that have occurred across the globe, with UNICEF reporting that more than 1.6 billion children and young people have been affected. Schools provide a food lifeline for children, for many daddies where they get their only nutritious meal of the day. In January, the UNICEF Office of Research, Innocenti, and WFP released a new report that found that more than 39 billion in school meals have been missed worldwide since the pandemic began. The pandemic has exposed the weakness of the industrialized global food system, which depends on long, complex transportation chains and cross-border travel. The monstrous and unsustainable food industry known as Big Ag relies on the horrendous treatment of laborers, a wasteful allocation of resources, worldwide environmental devastation, and in a pinch can quickly devolve into near collapse of the entire system, as evidenced by the delays, shortages, and pressures during the COVID-19 pandemic and the deepening hunger crisis in America. April M. Short, a fellow at the Independent Media Institute, recently wrote, "Among the many necessary systematic changes 2020 has illuminated is the need to majorly restructure the way we cultivate and access food in our communities. It didn't take the pandemic to reveal the inefficiency and injustice of the food system. Globally, a third of all food is wasted, while nearly 690 million people were undernourished in 2019, almost 60 million more people than in 2014. But the pandemic has underscored the matter. According to OCHA, the number of acutely food insecure people could increase to 270 million due to COVID-19, representing an 82% increase compared with the number of acutely food insecure people pre-COVID-19. And the disruption of transportation has shown that the long distances it normally takes for food to get from one place to another can be a serious liability during a crisis. Food insecurity has long been a pressing issue, particularly for developing countries. However, as Mir Ashrafun Nahar, a research associate at the South Asian Network on Economic Modeling, explained in a Financial Express article, the COVID-19 pandemic has made it more acute. In response, Nahar argues for a policy-based approach that includes subsidy-based transportation system for agriculture to support supply chains, as well as policies aimed at cutting down on agricultural production costs in order to help farmers recover from the effects of the pandemic. The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD, an intergovernmental economic group with 37 member countries, said that the pandemic has laid bare pre-existing gaps in social protection systems in a report published in June 2020. While the impacts of COVID-19 are still unfolding, experience so far shows the importance of an open and predictable international trade environment to ensure food can move to where it is needed, the OECD report states. It added, "The biggest risk for food security is not with food availability, but with consumers' access to food. Safety nets are essential to avoid an increase in hunger and food insecurity." Another problem is the lack of media coverage about the food insecurity being witnessed around the world, particularly during the COVID-19 era, as The Economist recently pointed out. Journalists in 2020 wrote more than 50,000 articles about the cancelled Eurovision contest, but only around 2,000 about drought and hunger in African countries. For meaningful reform to the food system to occur, change is going to happen at early level, from national, state, and local governments to big ag, small farmers, and everyday consumers.
food for thought.
Salam everybody and heartiest congratulations to you all on the 27th of Rajab, which is indeed one of the major Islamic festivals. Since this marks the formal start of the mission of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, as the Almighty's last and greatest messenger to mankind. So let us ponder on a wise saying from the Prophet. You should reward them who do you favor. If you cannot reward them, you should thank. Showing gratitude is a sort of rewarding.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. What would have happened if Hezbollah had been vanquished? That's perhaps the most significant and upsetting question about the 2006 war.
Much has been said about the 2006 war, about its motives, the behind the scenes, and the circumstances around it, its planning and developments, its details and objectives, as well as its outcome and the lessons learned from the war. Also, much speculation has been made about what led to the war. When considering the situation in Lebanon, in the occupying Zionist regime, in Palestine, and in the region, as well as the U.S. role in the war, one of the main issues that needs a close look is what would have happened if the resistance in Lebanon was defeated.
How did Hezbollah defeat Israel?
Part 3.
Speaking of a hypothetical defeat would not be possible without examining the history of Arab defeats. Just as one cannot hypothesize about Hezbollah's defeat without taking into account the nature and identity of the supposed winner. There are two other questions that have to be asked. One is, how did Israel overcome the Arabs? And the other is, how did Hezbollah defeat Israel? Only then can one hypothesize about the consequences of a Hezbollah defeat in the 2006 war. The World Cup opening match was held between Argentina and Belgium. On that day, the Lebanese capital Beirut was under attack by Israeli fighter jets and tanks that had the city under siege. The siege happened during the World Cup, where two Arab nations, Kuwait and Algeria, were present. Algeria beat Germany, and Kuwait Football Federation chief Fahad al-Ahmed al-Sabah halted the Kuwait-France match to protest France's fourth goal. He fought for 7 minutes, and the referee was forced to annul the goals.
As Israelis stepped up their bombing campaign, battle intensified. We thought Beirut burning under fire would shock the world, that the world will react to landing of a mortar, al-Burj al-Baraj building in the city, and the deaths of at least 75 innocent humans. We witnessed rallies in Algeria, but we later realized that they were just cheering for Algeria's victory against Germany in the World Cup.
Demonstrations were held across the Arab world because they thought Algeria's elimination from the World Cup had been a fix. But no one took to the street for the occupation of the second Arab capital after Al-Quds. Before the establishment of Hezbollah, Lebanon had seen several conflicts with Israel. There were two kinds of wars. Firstly, the partisan and army battles where national and Palestinian resistance groups were involved. And secondly, the battle fought by the Syrian army in the 1982 Lebanon-Israel conflict. In 1982, Israeli forces were double the combined number of troops Syria and Egypt had deployed in the October 1973 war. But Israel faced two different forms of resistance, military and non-military, in Lebanon. But how did Israel achieve victory against them? The natural elements of the Lebanese battlefield and its complex geography, with its heights and narrow passes through the mountains, left Israel no option but to employ new tactics. The strategy relied on heavy use of infantry and greater use of units than Israel dispatched for the 1973 war, but across a smaller area of only 70 kilometers. Israel used the maximum number of troops possible to take control of main crossways and sensitive points overlooking key towns and cities while taking hold of key geographical locations. To be able to reorganize its forces, Israel wanted a second portion of its troops to quickly advance towards Beirut, while the first groups had resistance forces encircled. The second group was to be supported by special forces, who would provide them with their needed equipment deep in Lebanese territory through marine or air transport methods. However, the Israeli army faced a demographic factor, a major geostrategic element in the war. They didn't have the needed experience to fight in urban and residential areas. Classic armies naturally avoid entering populated areas to prevent troop casualties, since such areas are full of buildings that limit movement. The Israeli forces were built upon heavy armored units supported by infantry, but Tel Aviv had not improved its infantry tactics, despite the fact that its troops had to fight face-to-face battles
against popular resistance forces to be able to encircle them. The low number of Israeli infantry units gave the Lebanese and Palestinian resistance groups the opportunity of free movement and of engaging Israeli forces, though they failed to use the existing opportunity. The Lebanese National Resistance Front and the Palestinian Resistance Forces retreated as the classic Israeli army advanced into Lebanon. That was done in accordance with non-military principles without undermining their policy of confrontation. This is what Chinese leader and one of the most significant guerrilla war theorists, Mao Zedong, used to say. He said, "Escape when an army attacks you, confront it when it settles down, and follow it when it retreats."
Yasser Arafat used his entire experience of guerrilla wars. He had access to the experience of a full range of resistance movements, including those from Russia and Algeria, as well as weapons from across the globe. The Japanese also helped him along with their Red Army, German guerrilla group Bader-Menov Group, and Italy's Red Brigades. All of them sympathized with the Palestinian issue, as they had Arab countries' facilities at their disposal, and even had interests in the Arab oil industry. The Palestinian resistance staged a hard-fought partisan battle since the very establishment of the Zionist regime. The battle had a history of ups and downs, both in Palestine and outside, including in Jordan and Lebanon. Therefore, it was not a domestic guerrilla war, and there is no partisan battle except that it gains victory. This is a historically recognized fact based on the experience of the wars of the past.
On October 6th, the Israeli army, equipped with large numbers of Merkava tanks, launched a pitched battle against Lebanon. Israeli forces began advancing along several axes with a focus on the coastal areas. One of the most important classic battles of the 1982 war took place here in this place, where Israeli and Syrian armies engaged in the Battle of Sultan Yaqub. During the battle, Syrian army forces inflicted heavy damage on Israeli armored personnel carriers that stopped them from advancing. In just 5 days, the Israelis managed to extend their domination to two-thirds of Lebanon. That was when they realized the road to Beirut was all clear. They were finally within kilometers of the Lebanese capital on June 9th. On that day, Lebanon witnessed one of the heaviest air battles in modern times.
كان البقاع ولا يزال جزءا من النطاق الأمني السوري إلى دمشق وسوريا.
Beqa has always been part of Syria's security margin for Damascus. Therefore, Syria has to keep its security presence at the border town to make up for Lebanon's weak border security in the valley. If not, Israelis could use the Beqa area to enter Lebanon, while military forces in Bilad al-Sham, Greater Syria, which is 30 kilometers away from Beqa, could not defend the area. Therefore, Syria had to set up its defenses from outside of Bilad al-Sham and deployed its SAM-6 anti-air defense system to Lebanon to that end. The key issue here is that back in 1982, the Israeli enemies wanted both to get rid of the Palestinian Liberation Organization and prevent Arabs, especially Syrians, from repeating the victories they gained during the 1973 war. Arabs could reduce Israel's air superiority through creation of a semi-active air defense system, providing more ease of movement to Syrian and Egyptian forces. The advantage cost Israelis part of their air force and surprised them for a short period of time, providing the Arab side of the war with a sort of a victory. In fact, all of that was an achievement of the air defense systems of Egypt and Syria, especially the latter's, as Syrian soldiers used the air defense system with ultimate skill.
In In June 1982, the Israelis resorted to destroying missile systems in an attempt to prevent limited successes of the Arabs in the October War. After the destruction of the air defense systems, Syrians deployed 100 aircraft to counter the Israelis' air assaults. The Israelis responded with ambushing the Syrian fighter jets. One of such tactics was the use of F-16 aircraft able to tackle air-to-air missiles of Syria's MiG-23 fighter jets, leading to the destruction of a large number of Syrian jets, up to 36 of them.
In 1982, the Syrian army faced a large-scale attack that led to many deaths. They forced Syria out of southern Beirut and the Jabal area and besieged Syrian forces in Beqa. They pushed the large Syrian contingent out of southern Beirut. The 85th Brigade left Beirut with its flag lowered due to a planned peace agreement. On the fifth day of the war, Israel ended the battle with Syria, setting the stage for talks.
This was the climax of the Israeli military doctrine's achievements. The doctrine proved to itself and to the world that it is effective and successful both against popular resistance movements and military tactics of classic armies, as it overcame both classic and non-classic methods of battle on Lebanese soil.
Palestinian resistance groups also did their best, including by volunteer operations, aircraft hijacking, and domestic operations, but they led nowhere.
Only then did a man emerge before the eyes of the world who said Israel had been trapped. And at his hands and under his supervision, we were told of the auspicious birth of a unique form of fighting, comprised of the three elements of faith, jihad, and martyrdom, so that it sets out a new direction, which Ruhollah dubbed Hezbollah. The party of Allah, they will be predominant. And only a few years later, Yitzhak Shamir told the world that Hezbollah are only a different sort of Arabs.
The creation of the Islamic resistance in Lebanon shook the pillars of Israel's security doctrine. The Islamic resistance adopted a special method in the battle against the Israeli forces, which were defeated neither by classic armies nor in non-military battles. Hezbollah put up an unprecedented fight in the history of military science and overcame Israelis. The victory had nothing to do with the geographic elements, as the Palestinian resistance battled Israelis in the same environment. It was not also because Hezbollah was a Lebanese movement, as even the Lebanese and their popular movements fought Israel with the same weapons and on the same lands, but failed to defeat Israel. It was not the territory that gave Hezbollah the upper hand. As Palestinians engaged Israelis in the same territory, so did the Lebanese. Then what made the difference?
Tactic is the element that puts different forms of knowledge at the service of a battle. The more skillful and capable a commander, the fresher and more creative his military tactics would be. It means a capable commander's exceptional leadership and war plans are the results of defining the principles and rules of battle in a specific way. These two factors are in turn rooted in the commander's perception of the principles of war and his detailed assessment of the facts on the ground in the battlefield. The rules of battle can be both firm and flexible. Did Hezbollah develop a special tactic during its years of resistance? Is Hezbollah now in possession of a new technology they have adapted to the battlefield?
علم التكتيك
In theory, tactic is the knowledge of capabilities, technologies, and details. But in practice, tactic is the ability to create a link between creativity, flexibility, and moderate decision-making in the difficult conditions of the battlefield against a shrewd enemy, coupled with the commander's understanding of the human nature and the impact of the war on his soldiers. Therefore, when we say resistance shattered the enemy on the battlefield, it means the enemy was defeated on the three tactical, practical, and strategic levels. That was what led to the shattering of the enemy's national security doctrine.
Over the years, Hezbollah has been fighting Israel. The resistance developed a military concept of its own. Therefore, what it laid out in southern Lebanon was different from its entire experience of the past.
ما شهدناه في العام 2000 تحديدا من أداء لجنود ونخب العدو.
What we saw in the year 2000 was that enemy soldiers, its special forces and officers, as well as their whole military establishment, were present in Lebanon. However, none of them could give the slightest response to the operation by the resistance, which demonstrates any operation planned by the movement leads to victory, and nothing can be done to counter or stop it. This was the conclusion that led the enemy to retreat.
Israel was twice taken by surprise by Hezbollah. First, by Hezbollah's preparedness for war, and second, by its realization that what it accomplished in the past and the powerful means it used to make those accomplishments were no longer effective against such a well-prepared opponent. The July battle was different from all the past battles Israel had fought since its establishment. Military history proved the superiority of Hezbollah over Israel's military doctrine, which had earlier proved itself effective against the Arabs' both classic and non-classic warfare. Israel faced a new form of resistance, which was fledging back in 1982 and hit its climax in July 2006.
Some say the enemy was on the defensive before the year 2000. However, if we assume that invasion is the key decisive advantages in a war, it was Israel that had the advantage in 2006, as it was Israel that made the assault. We witnessed terrible scenes during the war. The enemy's performance was extremely poor. Researchers said the poor performance was rooted in Israel's failure to balance its forces and its reservists, as well as numerous other problems that made the true reasons behind Israel's failure. But the real reason for its defeat was the performance of enemy's soldiers and officers. Israel's military doctrine failed both in strategic and practical terms, while the failure was also visible in the different aspects of its military concepts and structures. Israeli military organization, soldiers, and officers were also unable to find appropriate methods to fight Hezbollah on the battlefield. But the more significant issue was the resistance movement's superiority to Israel in terms of its military doctrine, theory of the battle, and all strategic, practical, and tactical dimensions.
A new study has revealed a sad fact. Humans have destroyed around two-thirds of the world's tropical rainforests. according to a report by Rainforest Foundation Norway. Logging and land conversion has ruined 34% of tropical rainforest. They have also caused degradation of another 30%, which makes the forest more vulnerable to fire and destruction. The report says that since 2002, over half of the vanishing has occurred in South America's Amazon. Experts believe the loss of tropical forests makes climate change worse. Japan is famous for its vending machines, but the technology is now being used to improve public access to coronavirus test kits. A group of medical experts in a clinic has set up 7 vending machines across the capital, Tokyo, to sell their test kits. Customers take the PCR test and then mail off their saliva sample for processing. Each machine holds 60 kits. The idea was met with great enthusiasm from people. It helps them to avoid crowded clinics.
Without PCR tests, we can't make a diagnosis. Early diagnosis and early treatment is a basic idea for all diseases. But unfortunately, there is no treatment for COVID-19. So I strongly felt that we had to do early diagnosis and early isolation.
Experts believe the number of PCR tests conducted in Japan is extremely low. They hope that the initiative can increase the figure. The machines sell the kits at around $40 each.
Teams of racing dog enthusiasts have converged on the Russian city of Irkutsk to participate in a 150-kilometer marathon on ice. The contest was held on the icy surface of the famous Baikal Lake. The racers, who started off at 5 p.m., had to put up tents and use warm equipment to withstand temperatures as low as minus 12 degrees Celsius to spend the night. Participants are free to choose their tactics throughout the race.
What's good about this race is its straightforward format. Now the racers start off and we will stop the clock when they arrive. Where they sleep and eat and how they cover the distance is a matter of their personal strategy and tactics. This is a contest for the real athletes.
The dogs can help their owners find the right direction in case they are lost on the frosty path. They can seek help from other rivals too. The Baikal race is an annual event that was held for the 7th consecutive time this year.
Get ready for a big dose of cuteness. In India, dozens of little turtles have been released into sea. Forest officials in a southern Indian town let loose 131 endangered turtle hatchlings. They had kept the eggs for over 50 days until the day came to set them free. The environmentalists also plan to release 4 other cute turtles, which are still too shy to come out of their cozy eggs. Marine turtles have existed for more than 100 million years. The numbers have fallen in the past few years due to human activities. Moving on, NASA's Mars rover Dot Perseverance has successfully completed its first ever test drive on the red planet. The 6-wheeled rover traveled more than 6 meters in 33 minutes. NASA officials called the mission a huge milestone. They also released images showing the robot's wheel tracks on the surface of the planet and surrounding landscape. NASA engineers say they are now preparing for the first flight of a helicopter drone carried by the rover. Perseverance was launched last summer and landed on Mars earlier in February. Its main goal is to search for traces of ancient microbial life there. It is going to collect soil and rock samples from the Martian surface and send them back to the Earth in the next decade for analysis.
An Australian conservation group says it will build the world's first ever platypus refuge facility.
We're also going to build a platypus refuge, one of its kinds around the world. This refuge will be able to take up to 65 platypuses in a time of crisis. Right now there is so much to learn about the platypus, and we know so little. These facilities will be critical in building our knowledge so that we don't let this iconic creature slip off the earth.
Platypuses are among Australia's most unique and elusive animals. They're normally found across the country's eastern seaboard. The strange-looking creatures are the only remaining representatives of their family. They spend most of their lifetime underwater and alone. Australian authorities say the planned refuge facility can give them more information about the animal's preferred environment and breeding. Many habits of the platypuses have remained a mystery to researchers. family therapist in the U.S. state of California has come up with a brilliant idea to calm her angry clients, and that's a rage room. Yashika offers stressed people a smash session. The participants are allowed to destroy different items with a hammer, golf club, or baseball bat. They are required to wear protective gloves and face shields. During the session, the therapist also tries to teach the participants different ways to manage their stress in a healthy way.
So it's actually